Good afternoon. It is one bell of the afternoon watch. This is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair for our weekly gathering for muster for quarters. And I have listened to the last half of Susan's program, and I really urge everyone to come on half an hour before you fall in for muster with me around the captain's chair and listen to Susan's broadcast, because she always has interesting people. And besides that, she does some of the electronic magic for me that I so far have refused to learn. So I start off, as I always do, with a commentary about the binnacle list. And the binnacle list this week serves to remind me of how quickly things in our lives can change and how we need to be ready to deal with those changes and be ready to always take care of the people and the things for which we are accountable and responsible. So to do the little bit of housekeeping, this is from the captain's chair. It's on Voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band, and it is streamed live all over the world, from Singapore on one end of the world to Stockholm on the other. Stream live on voiceofvashon.org. All of the ships at sea, all of the aircraft in the air, all of the stations in between that listen to us loyally every week. And I have to also say that I don't know about other programs, I don't know about other producers, but I like to recognize and to thank all of Captain Joe's people who also support us financially, because that's how we keep me coming up in the chair every week, as well as all of the other program that I hope that all of you listen to. So here are the things that have happened in this last week. Last week when I walked in, I had heard that Captain O'Brien, my friend Truman, the retired Alaska Airlines captain, my friend, a wonderful person here on the island, has done so much good for so many people here on the island, had augured in his airplane with a colleague, a friend. And at that time, we did not know the extent of the damage, and we did not know either the extent of the damage to Truman or the extent of the damage to the aircraft. What we did know was that both of them got out of it alive. And since then, during the week, we have gotten together as an island family, a few friends who are particularly close to Truman and Mary O'Brien. And over at CC and Andy's, we got together for a dinner. And at that dinner, we had the debrief from Truman and from Craig, who was sitting in the right seat. And there was some protestations about how much luck was involved. And so I pontificated and delivered myself of not of the opinion, but based on a considerable amount of experience in the business of rescuing people who get into difficulties, that those which are successful, where the people survive, there is almost no luck involved. It is almost always because the person in charge, the person in command, in this case, the pilot in command, in this case, it was Truman, his skill, his knowledge, his experience, his training, his acceptance of the idea that the captain shall show no fear. You've heard me talk about that before, and I will talk about it again sometime at the appropriate time. That all of those factors came together, and in partnership with Craig, who was sitting in the right seat, who also accepted the instructions, accepted the leadership of the pilot in command, and knew that the success of both of them coming out of this alive depended on the two of them working together. Now, these are concepts that are near and dear to your captain's heart and soul. They are all true, and they all can be expanded into all sorts of other things having to do with how we live our lives and how we take care of those things for which we are responsible in life. So, not much luck, Captain O'Brien. Almost all of it from skill, experience, and showing no fear. Now, that doesn't mean that you aren't afraid. What it does mean is that you do not show that fear and communicate it to those for whom you are responsible, because in that, should you have done that, the little organization of the two of you would have fallen apart. So, a hearty well done. I have now seen photographs of the aircraft after it had been recovered, and it is with a great deal of interest that I look forward to the next step in the accident investigation, what caused that engine to fail. So, the second thing that happened was that on the 1st of April, exactly 10 months after Mary R's death, little Mary, little Miss Mary Sunshine, crossed her own bar, and she was just 2 years old, and she was only a cat. But she was not just a cat, she was also a metaphor for all of the people, humans, that we love. And I took her in because I needed somebody in the house to take care of. Sailor is like a good XO. Sailor is so self-contained, you instruct him and he goes off and he does his job, and he doesn't need much in the way of attention. He needs love, and he needs feeding, and he needs being instructed. But once that's done, you leave him alone, and he gets on with the tasks at hand. Sunday, we took a day off, and Sailor, kept wandering around the house looking for Miss Mary Sunshine. They had a great relationship, and it was truly the peaceable kingdom, the three of us living in that house, otherwise empty of people that we should have been there. So those are the two things that happened. Little Mary Sunshine died on the midwatch, as did Mary R. That is the time of greatest darkness and greatest danger to the sailor. And she fulfilled her mission, as did her namesake. And so those are the two things that happened. Mary Sunshine died just in a week. We think it was probably a cancer. So those are the two things that happened. And yet we have other things to remind us how quickly things can change. A friend who is now on her first anniversary dealing with a serious cancer, and each day I hope that we're all going to get through the next day. It's just terrible to have all these people that you love and to have them at risk. So, and then, of course, all of my Coast Guard people on the Coast Guard channel, there are a number of situations there which are also acquiring membership on the Binnacle list. And so all of those things are in my thoughts up here in the captain's chair as we move on into the next week. I tell you all of these things because we need to be thinking about how we're going to manage when something happens unexpectedly. In every night order book, set of night orders that I ever wrote, one of the pieces of it was to the officers of the watch during the night, imagine what you will do, have a plan ready as to what you will do if all of a sudden you see a bright flashing light up on the horizon, a ship suddenly appears that did not show up on the radar. And there are ships that do not show up on the radar. And all of a sudden, this ship is right there ahead of you, and you go, you have only one flash second in order to make a decision. Make that decision now. Be thinking now about what it is that you're going to do. And so that is my counseling, my wishes, my command from the captain's chair for today. I always like to get questions from loyal and dedicated listeners, and I have one that came to me today, or came to me a few days ago, in which I was asked to comment on the Suez Canal, and in particular, how much does it cost to take a ship through the Suez Canal? So I know the answer to that, and you yourself can figure it for yourself, because there are so many great things. There's so much trash and garbage, flotsam and jetsam as well, on the internet. But there are some really interesting things, and one of the most interesting things is that you too can go on to a website called the Suez Canal Calculator, and you can figure out how much it will cost to take a ship through the Panama Canal. Now, it is not as simple as that, of course. Not much in life is anymore, or ever was, not even back in Roman times. So you have to, if you're going to do this, you have to pick out a ship size and a type, and whether you're headed northbound or southbound. And you also need to figure out its Suez Canal tonnage. Now, ships have different kinds of tonnage. I tried to explain, and it is a pretty abstract concept, and it goes back at least 2,000 years, this idea of measuring ships by their profit-making capacity. So when we talk about a ship having a certain gross register tonnage, or a net tonnage, or some term like that, Suez Canal tonnage, Panama Canal tonnage, those are all measures of the ship's profit-making carrying capacity. They are not measures of weight. The weight of a ship is called its displacement tonnage. How much water does it displace when it is sitting in the water? That's called its displacement tonnage. And that is actually how much the ship weighs. So there are different tonnages for the measures of tonnage for the Panama Canal in calculating the fees than there are for the Suez Canal in calculating the fees. And there are other factors that go into it. So we did it for a ship which was a average bulk carrier. And an average bulk carrier might be about 700 feet long, and she might have a Suez Canal tonnage, remember her carrying capacity, not her weight, of let's say 85,000 tons. And you plug all of those things into the Suez Canal calculator, but you don't have to do this for yourself. I have done it for you. And I came out with a calculation of about $225,000 to take a bulk carrier through the Suez Canal headed northbound. Now, if we take a ship the size of Ever Given, then we are talking about a much, much larger ship with a much larger carrying capacity and probably double or even triple that amount. I did not run the numbers for her, and because I wanted to get some sort of an average. And I would say that we're pretty close. So let's say for the ship that we're talking about, Scott, here's the answer to your question. For one of the bulkers that is at anchor in the federal anchorage off your house and my house, it would probably cost about $225,000 to $230,000 U.S. dollars to take her through the Suez Canal. Evergreen Gibbon is now, of course, out of the canal. In fact, the Suez Canal has now been cleaned out of all of the backlog ships. And within the next few days, the Suez Canal Authority and all of the other people which are involved in investigating her situation have promised to have a preliminary report by this coming week. And that so maybe I will have something to report when we get into the following week, maybe by when it's time for us to fall in for quarters around the captain's chair. Actually, quarters are on the flight deck in this ship or on the quarter deck, depending on the type of ship. Never around the captain's chair. But when we all get together around the captain's chair next week, maybe I'll have something to report on Evergreen Gibbon. In the meantime, I was coming back from the mainland yesterday, and the ferry had come to a stop, and I was far enough forward that I could take a look out over the bow, and I could see that there was a very large container ship headed southbound for the port of Tacoma. I looked her up, and she was the MSC Trieste, flagged in Malta. You all remember that no matter where a ship is owned or where she's managed from, she could well be flagged in some other state. In this particular case, this ship is flagged in Malta. Her home port is Valletta, which is the capital of Malta. And she was about 1,000 feet long. And so I looked her up in marine traffic, and I found that she was rated at just over 13,000 TEUs. You all will remember that a TEU is a 20-foot equivalent unit. In other words, if the ship were loaded with 20-foot containers, that's how many she could carry, by that she is licensed and certificated to carry just over 13,000 TEUs. Evergreen Gibbon is certificated to carry 20,000 TEUs. Now, most containers today are 40-foot containers, and so to get a measure of how many 40-foot containers she's carrying, you just divide that by two. Simple sailors like me who can barely read or write have trouble with that calculation, but there are those of you out there who know how to do it, and Susan, who is right across from me, she knows how to do it. She's already figured it out. So this ship was headed for the port of Tacoma, and she's just about the largest container ship. She was down to her marks. She was down to the marks, which are painted and welded onto the side of the ship to show you how far down she can be loaded. And she was loaded down to her marks, and she is bringing in all of those things that come from Asia, including those models going to that model shop. And she was, and it remains to be seen what she'll be taking when she goes out. I will be watching for her to leave. She'll be leaving in either today or tomorrow, and headed back probably to Taiwan, and we'll see how well she's loaded as she goes out. Our balance of payments in this country, of course, is absolutely awful, and so let's hope that she goes out loaded with really, really good things. So that's the shipping news. And I am now going to take us to the book for this week. And the book for this week is a return to one which has become one of all-absorbing interest for me, and that's Josephus Daniels' book called The Wilson Years. And we are working our way through the second volume. And it's of interest because it's exactly 102 years ago that the Peace Conference was meeting in Paris, the Peace Conference at which out of which came the Treaty of Versailles, which ended formally and officially World War One. But during the Peace Conference, it is remarkable to me how many things on the surface appear as if they have changed, and down in the depths, down way inside the watertight envelope of the ship, things are pretty much the same. So one of the things that was holding up the whole peace conference, which is not really very well known, and it would have taken somebody like Josephus Daniels, who was the Secretary of the Navy under Wilson, to report this, that he was under an incredible amount of pressure from the Brits, from the Admiralty, from the First Lord of the Admiralty, who had been Winston Churchill during World War II, and from Jackie Fisher, who had been brought back from retirement to be the first Sea Lord, the senior seagoing officer in the British Admiralty, and all of the admirals who had been the fighting admirals with the Brits during World War One. And he was Daniels, as the Secretary of the Navy, was under incredible pressure from all of them to guarantee that Britain would be the most powerful seagoing navy in the world. The United States at that time had decided and had embarked on a construction program to build battleships known as dreadnoughts. And why they're called dreadnoughts is a subject for another philippic at another time. Battleships, that'd be enough to describe the word. That the United States had embarked on a very ambitious program to build battleships such that they would be equal to the fleet of the Royal Navy. Now, keep in mind that the Royal Navy had suffered some incredible losses during World War One. For example, at the Battle of Jutland, the HMS Queen Mary blew herself up because she had watertight hatches open all the way down into the magazines. There were some lessons learned from that, which had to be repeated in World War Two, as a matter of fact. So the British government, in this case His Majesty's government, wanted a guarantee from the United States that ships which were planned, ships that were even under construction, ships that had already been constructed and were in the fleet, would be decommissioned and scrapped such that the Brits would have world domination of the seas. And it was this particular aspect of the peace conference that has not gone very well reported anyplace else, but Daniels captures it, and I can just hear the accents of the Brits. This was Lloyd George, this was Lord Fisher's, this was all of the admirals, Jellicoe and Beatty, all of them leaning into Daniels, who they knew had the ear of Wilson. And Wilson is saying, don't bother me with these things. These are not nearly as important as bringing the League of Nations in and making it work so that we no longer ever have any war. Well, we all know the end of that particular story. It ended by World War II, and the discussion about whether the Treaty of Versailles was one of the causes of World War II continues today by historians. But in any case, I am once again recommending that if you can find a copy of the two volumes that Josephus Daniels wrote called The Wilson Years, the volume two that I am working my way through right now is on the anniversary of the events that led up to the completion of the Treaty of Versailles in, I believe it was June of 1919, from which sprang the League of Nations and which the United States did not accede to that treaty. The United States never joined the League of Nations, because the Senate, which has to agree to treaties, refused to accede to that treaty. And just as a little side note, and Daniels is really good at describing this as well, two of Wilson's closest advisors, Secretary of State Lansing and his closest personal advisor, Colonel House, all of those two people were undermining the agreement to accede to the League of Nations. Very, very interesting story. And if you want to draw some parallels as to where we are today, or if you'd like to draw some parallels with things that happened in centuries before, you are welcome to do that, not just as an intellectual exercise, but also because we constantly need to remind ourselves that those things that have happened in the past are going to shape what happens to us in the future. There is a wonderful photograph of two ships that have particular interest to Coast Guard people, and one of them is the USS Tulsa. USS Tulsa is one of the ill-fated littoral combat ships that the Navy built starting about 10 years ago. They are ships which are incredibly complex. They have never worked right. They have never had a mission that they were not built to fulfill a mission. They were ships that were seeking a mission. And so in this particular photograph, USS Tulsa is shown alongside the United States Coast Guard cutter Kimball. And my mind here, my critical mind about ships and the way they ought to operate is that they've got Tulsa and Kimball doing exercises together, and my suspicion is that Kimball is there to bend a tow line onto USS Tulsa should she fail, as have so many of her sisters. And then Kimball can take credit for a towing exercise and to tow her home wherever it is that they're working out of. I didn't even get the home ports. A quick note here that I am watching very carefully what's going on in the Arctic. There's an incredibly high level of new Russian presence in the Arctic. I'm going to be talking about that some more in a future broadcast. And we once again have come far too quickly to the end of our time together. So it remains then for me to give my customary and now traditional hopes, wishes, commands that all of us who are responsible for people that we love, that have been entrusted to our care, that we fulfill all of the obligations. Remember, the captain shall show no fear. And that we watch out for those we love. We watch out for those that we don't love, because maybe we will come to love them and maybe they will come to love us. And in any case, it can do no harm. So remember that we never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. My friend Nadine is taking a journey tomorrow, going to leave the magical Isle of Vashon and go back to Missouri. One wonders why one would go to Missouri when they could be here. But that's another story for another time. And as always, your Captain Joe is up in the captain's chair, on station, and watching properly.